If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Rob Attar, the magazine's editor. In today's episode, you'll be hearing from Susanna Lipscomb, who's Professor of History at the University of Roehampton, as well as being a well-known presenter of history TV programmes. Her most recent book, The Voices of Neame, draws on her archive research to reveal what life was like for women in 16th and 17th century France. And that was the subject of her interview with fellow historian Dan Jones, which took place at Susanna's home a little while back.
Well, hello, listeners to the History Extra podcast. It's a real privilege and for me a great pleasure to be sitting at home with Professor Susanna Lipscomb. Just to set the scene for you, we're in her rather wonderful study office at home, and I'm very happy to be holding in my hands a copy of Professor Lipscomb's new book. Don't laugh, it's your actual title. The Voices of Neame, Women, Sex and Marriage in Reformation Languedoc. Now, I know a lot of you will know Susanna from TV shows in which she plays Batman to my Robin. She's a wonderful TV presenter. She's written several books before, mostly both, I think, on Tudor England. How many books have you written?
This is the fifth.
This is the fifth?
Yeah.
She's written more books than I realised. Most recently, one on the will of King Henry VIII.
And between those, a tiny little one on witchcraft.
And a tiny little one on witchcraft, of course. I'd forgotten about that one. Well, The Voices of Neame is a very special book, and I don't want you to take my word for that. Take the word of Professor Sir Simon Sharma, who says, and this is quoted on the back cover, Susanna Lipscomb's extraordinary Voices of Neame performs that miracle which only the most powerful historians can execute, using a dense archive to reawaken lost lives. This is a beautiful book, grippingly written, and destined to become a classic of social history. I mean, how do you top that? I suppose the first thing to ask, I'm going to call you Susie because it feels more informal. And since you are Batman and I'm Robin. Susie, tell us about Voices of Neame. What is it all about?
Okay, so it's all about women living in the 16th century in the south of France. And it is an insight into the lives of very ordinary women of you know, what we'd call sort of working class, but, you know, the wives of butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. And it tells incidents from their lives. So a lot of these stories have come out of a set of records known as the consistory. So in the south of France, in the second half of the 16th century, lots of people converted to Protestantism, and certain towns became bastions of this new faith, where they were also known as Huguenots. And Nîmes is one of those towns, Montpellier another, Montauban another, in contrast to, say, the Catholic towns of Avignon or Toulouse. And where people converted, they would establish a church that was a sort of Presbyterian system, which was governed by elders. So lay elders, ordinary members of the community, all men, who had a role in running the church and also, above all, presiding over morality in the town. And at a time of religious war, it was thought that preserving the morality of the town was the way to keep them from God's wrath. And when you're trying to control morals, in the 16th century at least, above all, that means you're trying to control women. And so as a result of this sort of desire for a moral status of their town, we have all sorts of records of interrogations and reprimand of women. And in the stories they tell, we get insight into their lives. And so this is what this book is about.
So I think for a lot of listeners, they may be slightly surprised that you've written a book about 16th century France, because I think a lot of us would associate you with work on the Tudor court, on Henry VIII, on Elizabeth. That's what you've done a lot of television work about. You've written books about this. Why did you choose to write about women in the south of France in the 16th century?
So, in fact, this work on the French archives predates the work on the Tudors. It was what I did my doctorate on years ago. And then I became a curator at Hampton Court and started writing about Henry VIII. So we're still in the same century, just different ends of it and across the channel, and actually different levels of society rather than Henry VIII and the court. We're talking about very ordinary people. But I came back to it because I felt like I hadn't finished with them yet, with these women, and I wanted to bring their stories to life. And I had access to this amazing set of records that a couple of other historians who are living have read and written about. There's a big French doctoral thesis, which is, you know, the sort of magnum opus, which is a very quantitative look at these cases. And then there's an American historian called Raymond Mensah, who's done a little bit with them. But most people haven't, because they're buried in a provincial archive. And also, there's been a sense that what these records could tell us about was the sort of ecclesiastical history, the status of the church, not interesting things about social history. So once I had discovered that actually they had insights to tell, I wanted to dig deeper with them and find out other records that could complement them.
So this is an archive down in the south of France that you started working with when?
So back in 2002. So I'm that old. A long time. So there's an archive in Nîmes, there's one in Montauban, one in Montpellier, there's some stuff in Paris. I mean, there are various archives, but yes, a set of records.
How did you come across these archives? What drew you to them?
So I was interested, when I was at university, we were asked to write a comparative history essay my last year. Oxford was experimenting with this form of getting you to write about a theme in two periods of history. So I wrote about religious violence in 16th century France and in 19th, 20th century India. And one of the things that emerged as a kind of the basis of religious violence is often that women are the target of it. And of course, we see this in warfare since, for example, in Bosnia, rape as a method of warfare. So I became interested in women in the religious wars and started to think about doing something on that. And then it was just sort of poking around. It came from a bit of a tip-off from a man called Philip Benedict, a very, very good historian, and Robin Briggs, who became my doctoral supervisor, that perhaps these court records might have something to say that's of use. Because obviously we've had decades of work where people have worked with court records. Most famously, of course, Montaigu, the story of a medieval French village in which there was the Cathar heresy at large, and have produced real riches about social and ordinary life. And they said, oh, maybe there'll be something in those. And so I went looking.
Tell us about the archive. What does it look like?
Well, I've been going to it for so long that it has changed. So when I first went there, it was this tiny little room, and it was, and in fact, the one in Montauban still is this, and you wait for quite a while for them to go and find the manuscript you're interested in. Quite a lot of the time, early on, they wouldn't let me see the actual manuscripts. They'd only let me see the microfilm. And that was a real problem because French archives seem to be filled with genealogists who want to go and find out all of their family history. And so there was always a bit of a fight.
I think English archives are quite like that as well, aren't they?
Well, perhaps so. But I certainly, turning up earlier and earlier to join the queue so that I'd get a microfilm machine. But then anyway, as time went on, they got confident that I wasn't about to sort of destroy the things and started letting me out the manuscripts themselves. And these days they're like, oh, yes, please.
So are these... So in working with a little bit, are they particularly fragile? I mean, what do they look like?
Yeah, so they are books bound in vellum, calf leather, and they're parchment. They're very beautiful. The handwriting is particularly bad. So one of the reasons people haven't read them before is that the scrawl is often quite hard to decipher. And they are, to my mind, some of the most beautiful things you can imagine. So they're not, I wouldn't say they're fragile, but, you've got page after page of this scrawl. Do you want to see a picture of them?
Well, I've got the book in my hand at the moment, and there are some rather beautiful images. These are, I think, the pictures of the documents that you've been using.
Yes.
So yeah, they're in quite a, it's neater than my handwriting. So I've got quite a low bar for what decent handwriting looks like. But I imagine, as with any record, it takes a while to get your eye in.
Exactly.
To not only the language, but also the hand.
That's right. So it's 16th century French, and as different from modern French as 16th century English is from ours. And it's written by people who are literate and who, as you say, in fact, I think the one you're looking at is quite a nice hand. Some of them are better than others, but they aren't very literate. So that, for example, punctuation is not often used, and pronouns are easily confused between different people, and so it's quite hard to keep the hang of what's going on. And of course, so this is a scribe writing down in the courtroom. It's not a courtroom exactly, but come back to that. In the courtroom, writing down what is happening in front of them and translating it very quickly into the third person, possibly translating it into French. Much of the proceedings may have taken place in Occitan, the local dialect, and occasionally they quote from that. Or they may have been asking questions in French and then getting responses in Occitan. And probably these are the clean copies. Rough copies were made but not kept.
So you're dealing with legal records, which I think most historians who've come across legal records know that they present a unique set of problems. But maybe we'll come on to that in a minute. Let's set the scene more broadly as we work our way into this topic. Tell us what the south of France, the Languedoc, was like in the late 16th century. You've mentioned a little bit that there are Protestant towns, there are Catholic towns, there are obviously tensions connected to the Reformation. But as you do in the book, so evocatively, set the scene of this countryside. What's going on? What does it look like? What is it like to live there?
Well, if anyone's been down to the south of France, you'll have a sense that it is this very beautiful and in some ways quite wild place. We're talking about an area between the Camargue, which is a sort of area of marshland south of Nîmes, which connects up to the coast, and the Cévennes, which are a sort of slightly barren hills with these plateaus on which the sheep farming takes place. And we've got gorse growing there and olives and cypress. It's very Mediterranean. It gets very hot in the summer and pretty cold in the winter. There are famously the Mistral wind, which drives people mad, is present in February. I lived there for 7 months and I'm surprised I moved back, actually. At the time, it was... You could get some wine, but the wine wasn't as good as it is today.
At the time in the 16th century, not the time that you were living.
Yes, yeah.
Right. Obviously. Why was the wine not so good?
Because they didn't know about late harvesting and keeping it till the sugar had matured and the grapes had got more sweet.
So the Côte d'Argent that one would drink today is markedly superior to the...
Absolutely. So only since the 18th century have they had that knack, really. Right. As I understand it. But anyway, that's an aside. And the other thing about it is, if you go down to visit Nîmes today, you can actually see the print or the sort of footprint of the original 16th century city. It's still the old town now. It's kind of shield-shaped town and marked by some Roman ruins. So at the bottom of Nîmes, there is this amazing amphitheatre, Les Arènes, which is... I think, or you know, can compete with anything you can find in Rome. And there's also an amazing Roman temple called the Maison Carrée. So these Roman ruins, and then a fountain, a watchtower. So Nîmes was properly mapped out. And when I went to live there, I actually managed to live in the centre of this old town, coincidentally on the road that the consistory met on, which is rather lovely. And at the time, it, however, was a place of great tumult because outside of Nîmes, intermittently, there was warfare raging. There were times during the 1580s, for example, when if you were a Protestant and you were found outside of Nîmes, you might be killed by Catholic forces that were ravaging the area, because across France, there was this battle between the Protestants and Catholics, often happening at an elite level, but also being carried out in the fields of France, between ordinary people.
And I suppose to set this in even broader historical context, this is also an area that has successively been kind of ridden through by English armies during the Hundred Years' War previously. I mean, as they're fighting Burgundians, Armagnacs, you know, so there is a history in this part of France of warfare, instability, political and military unrest.
And heterodoxy. So this is this area is a stone's throw from where the Cathar heresy grew up a few centuries earlier. And there's a sort of independent spirit. Languedoc is now, you know, subsequently part of France, but there's a sense that it has its own identity and it adopts a new point of view.
Which is there in its name.
Exactly. The Languedoc, the language in which you say yes with the word oc as opposed to oui, the language of the north.
So culturally quite different from northern France, with this history of turbulence, warfare, religiously heterodox and, you know, and splits between, as the Reformation comes along, Catholic and Protestant. Okay, so this is the area in which we're operating. Let's hone in a little bit then on Nîmes itself and the consistory, which forms the sort of spine of the material that you've worked with in this book. Tell us a little bit about what that was, what its purpose was, how it regulated morality and legality in society.
So the consistory was the governing body and welfare centre of the local church. It handed out money to poor people and it determined things like whether the windows in church could be opened on a Sunday. But it also had this role in moral reprimand and supervision. So it was made up of between 10 and 18 men, the ministers of the church, a number of deacons who were sort of a slightly higher post who were responsible for poor relief. And they oversaw the elders who were appointed to oversee a number of streets local to them. And so they were literally observing their neighbours, looking out for any wrongdoing, people going into other people's houses at the dead of night.
So this is sort of institutionalised curtain twitching.
Exactly. In fact, what it does is it goes further than that. It's not just the elders who end up doing it, it's neighbours who end up denouncing each other. And so this culture of prurience and voyeurism really sort of grows up.
And where does this spring from? I mean, obviously we're talking about a time and a place where there isn't a police force to police law and the areas in which that impinges on morality. Is this a sort of religious police of the sort that we might imagine now in countries like Saudi Arabia?
Yes, so this is exactly this. So, in fact, to be specific, it doesn't have legal power, this consistory. Technically, it's only it's a religious court, is even stretching it slightly. So it's a religious tribunal before which people are called. But a lot of the people who are on the consistory are also people in positions of power in the town council or who are consuls. That's how these southern towns are governed. And so in practice, there is some heft behind what the consistory is doing.
And is this something that's particular to the Protestant Reformed Church, or was it something that existed before the Reformation as well?
It is especially developed it by the Protestants. I mean, because it involves so many lay people in the governance of society, which isn't really something that the Roman Catholics would have adopted. And also, there's a specific reason why we don't have this sort of these sort of records from Roman Catholic areas, although we do have some bishops' tribunals. We don't have it from, you know, ordinary people policing each other, because people's sins are dealt with in the privacy of the confessional, as opposed to being aired before this panel of judges who will, you know, lay judges, but judges all the same, who will then determine what punishment should be imposed.
Right. So we have a sort of semi-official moral police, neighbourhood watch type organisation institutionalised in the consistory. What sort of cases would come before this this body?
So any form of moral failing, dancing comes up quite a lot.
You should see me dance. It's a genuine moral sin to see me dance.
Well, you'd have certainly been before them. And in fact, you'd also have been there for your speech, because...
For my speech?
You've been very clean so far today, but generally speaking, any profanity...
Blasphemy
would call somebody before the consistory.
Serious stuff. Like if I dropped something on my foot, damn, that hurt.
Yes, that sort
of thing. That's enough.
Yeah, invoking the devil. People did that in speech sometimes, and that was considered very serious.
The devil took this copy of The Voices of Neem, which has landed on my foot.
Yes, you'd be in trouble now.
I'd be right up before the beat.
Yes, and we've got a recording of it, so we know it's...
So dancing?
We've got proof. Dancing.
Swearing.
Swearing. All manner of sexual misbehaviour. So adultery, obviously, sex before marriage. When we do one or two cases of homosexual activity disappear very quickly from the pages because they're considered so serious, they're sent to be considered in front of the actual legal magistrates. But in for heterosexual misdemeanors certainly appear a lot. And also quarrels, when people have fought with each other, that appears a lot as well. People going to Roman Catholic services, even if they've stood at the back and not participated. There's a whole, you know, so if they've carried out superstitious rituals, if they've gone to see one of the bohemians, they're called, the sort of soothsayers or local fortune tellers, you know, there's basically a lot of activity that will bring you before the consistory.
So this would bring you up before the consistory. And what sort of punishments could they hand down?
The consistory itself could only hand down spiritual punishments, i.e. shaming punishments, like being called before the consistory itself and having to say that you're sorry and that you shouldn't have done it.
So actually being called before the consistory is punishment in itself, in a way?
To be interrogated isn't, but then to have to perform the sort of ritual of apology is. But worse still is to do so on a Sunday in front of the entire congregation. This is a point at which everybody, nearly everybody, I would have thought, is required to go to church every Sunday. Whether they are or not is another thing, but they are required to be at church. They're not allowed to have shops open during services, for example. Some of the elders go and walk around and check they're not doing that. So everybody's there, and in front of everybody, you have to say what you've done. If you refuse to do that, or if you commit the sin again, then they might excommunicate you from the church, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but actually means that you're thrust out of both social and economic community, and you can't do business with people, you can't socialise with members of the church. So it is actually quite serious.
And you're going to hell.
Well, there's that too, yes.
Worse than anything, that, isn't it? Hell?
They certainly believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I mean, only being half flippant, this is a very, excommunication in a predominantly Christian religious age is a serious punishment, because your mortal soul is in jeopardy, as well as no one will talk to you down the pub.
Yeah, and it's very hard to believe, to sort of to get one's head around how deeply they feel the need to be seen to be respectable. I mean, there was John Ronson did that book a few years back about being shamed online, and I think that's the only sort of comparison that we can have. The shame factor is very, very high. To be shamed in front of your community and then to think that this is going to have eternal consequences is very serious indeed.
Well, I think you pick up on a good point by mentioning that Ronson book, which was sort of, I guess, the thesis in Bronson's book is that the forum for public shaming in some sense today has moved on to the internet and principally onto social media sites. Do you think it's the case that every society in some way has these kind of shaming forums and rituals and mechanisms? I mean, is that just a part of society? And is what we're seeing in Nîmes, it's expressed through the consistory?
I think that seems like a plausible hypothesis. I mean, perhaps there was a period where, before social media, where we thought that we were past all that and, you know, it's absolutely fine to have children outside of marriage and it's absolutely fine to have relationships with anyone you've
fancied. Well,
except that
you had the tabloid press, which would, you know, gleefully, as I remember growing up in the 90s, you know, moral scandal, you know, shutting your whatever in the fridge door or having a kid with the...
That's true. I suppose for most ordinary people wouldn't appear in the tabloid press, but certainly a certain class of, if you had any sort of public standing at all, you might do. Mm. And so I suppose that's the equivalent. So perhaps, yes, I mean, I can't think of, but that was my best guess at a time when we might have said we were past it, but we weren't. It was just waiting to make a return.
Okay, so let's get back to the specifics of Nîmes. We have this organisation. It can shame you. It can punish you. Talk to us a little bit about women in society in the south of France at this time, because that's what you focus on using this book. It's a case studies that draw out aspects of women's lives more generally through their interaction with the consistory. So tell us a bit about women in the south of France.
Okay, so women in the 16th century, generally speaking, are operating at a disadvantage to men. I mean, this is a patriarchal society in which women have no official positions of power, that they cannot hold, you know, they don't have roles in church, they don't have roles in the law, in government. They don't own anything after marriage. It all belongs to their husband. They cannot operate a business except as a widow. And so it goes on. And so it's a situation in which, in all sorts of ways, physical beliefs about women's lack of strength and lack of mental power, the sort of legal status of women and their economic status, women are subservient to men.
And is it the case that this has, you know, by the late 16th century, got worse? I mean, you write in the book that the Reformation regenerated patriarchy. Controlling morality was about controlling women. Is this something that has got sort of qualitatively worse for women since the Reformation arrives in France?
So this is a finding originally from Professor Linda Roper and her work in 16th century Germany. There was a sense at one point that people thought that Reformation might have meant things were better for women. Suddenly, you know, they had an opportunity to be considered and valorized as worthy through their role as wife and mother. But in actual fact, all it does by saying that a woman's worth is in those things is to confine her to those roles particularly. So there's very much a sense that things are getting worse in that in the late 16th century, we see, well, this is the period, of course, where we see people being accused of witchcraft. We see in both France and England, the crime of infanticide comes to the fore and women are accused of being scolds. There is a sense in which women acting independently, speaking in ways that are considered dangerous, or doing things which bring them power at this time are making men a bit alarmed.
So yet another bad time to be a woman in history.
It's a very bad time to be.
Quite a lot of them. Now, is it the case that proportionally more women appeared before the consistory? I mean, did it take a particular interest in policing women's lives? Or is this just the area you focused on with your work?
I'm not sure to give a statistic in terms of proportionately, but I would say that because women are considered to be the source of sin, going back to Tertullian saying that, you know, Eve's the devil's gateway, you know, we've got this very much that if the sexual sin, obviously it's the woman who's caused it, it's the woman who's at fault. Now, the consistory are more egalitarian in their punishment and their justice in that they do call men before the court, whereas other courts don't necessarily do so. For example, one of the other sources I look at is a register of criminal sentences, and there's a womanizer called Pierre Delhoest who comes up a few times in having slept with various people. But the punishments are doled out just to the women in, this is in the town of Montauban, and the town consuls are punishing the women. The men are mentioned, they know who they are, but there's no punishment given to them. So the consistory is different in that it's actually even summoning the men before the court, but still a lot of cases like this, the focus is on the women's behaviour.
Coming up on the History Extra podcast.
Well, also what's interesting about it, as you said, is Isabel Isbiar is a Catholic and she is trying to use the Protestant consistory to get a Protestant.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest, whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Man to marry her.
Now, what I love most of all about Voices of Neem, about your book and all of this, is that there is this real sense that you've got right into the archives and pulled out some extraordinary cases. And so I'd like to talk about a few of them in their specifics and in their detail. And maybe we should start with the case that you open the book with, which is the case of Gillette de Girardet.
Yes.
Thank you. Who you open the book sort of with this wonderful scene of her refusing to, or coming before the consistory, being told she ought to marry this fella that she clearly doesn't want to. And she says, I'm not going to do that because guess what? I'm already married to Jesus Christ. Now, when I first read this, I thought, well, she must be a nun because that was the sort of way of framing it. But that's the sort of medievalist in me talking. Tell us a bit about this case. What was Gillette up to? And why did she go around claiming to be married to Christ?
This is a wonderful case because what people have thought at the time is that, you know, marriage is the horizon of a woman's hopes and dreams in the 16th century, and that a woman choosing not to marry is bucking that trend completely. So she is an 18-year-old living in Aigues-Mortes, which is a lovely walled town south of Nîmes, just on the edge of the Camargue. And she has, by some people's accounts, promised to marry a man called Antoine Dumois, but she swears that she hasn't. And the rumour has gone around that she said she's married to somebody else, and so the consistory ask her who she says she's married to, and this is when she says she's married to Jesus Christ. And it
big
is...
big reveal, by the way. Who is it? You're never going to guess.
And it was...
It's a big guy.
The consistory obviously weren't very happy about this because as far as they were concerned, they were the ones who mediated the relationship between God and woman in this case. And certainly you can't have young girls suddenly saying that they have some sort of special relationship with God that hasn't been, you know, approved by the church. And it also flies in the face of the fact that if she has said she will marry, the consistory is very concerned about engagements being properly enacted and marriage being properly enacted. And if you have promised to marry somebody under all of the sort of right conditions, soberly, without compulsion, made in the presence of witnesses, etc., it is as binding as a marriage vow. So it is something of great concern to them. So what's going on is her father had just died, and she apparently had been confronted by some of the men of the town, all considerably older than her, who are related to this man that claims to be married to her. And they had really, I think, wanted to get from her certain of her father's estate, a raft that had been lent out to them, which is important when you're in the marshlands of the Camargue to go fishing or whatever. And they force her into a situation where, in her sort of grief-stricken moment, she will promise to marry this man. But she denies it completely. She's asked by the consistory if she has promised to marry this chap, and she says no. And they said, well, but didn't he give you a ring? And she said, oh, well, yes, he did, but it wasn't in the name of marriage. It was in the name of friendship. And do you still have it? No, I've thrown it away. It's not a thing of much consequence. And so she's trying to deny what happened. And the other thing is that in the situation in which the engagement happened, she consistently said she would marry if God wished it. So although she doesn't want to marry Antoine Dumas, by saying she's married to Jesus Christ, and even at the time of the engagement, by saying she would only do it if God wanted it, she would marry when God wanted it to happen, et cetera, et cetera, she has used a narrative to the consistory in saying that this is about God's judgment, and that it's not right for her to marry him, which won't stand up, but she thinks perhaps it will.
What was her fate?
Her fate, unfortunately, in this instance, does not turn out as she wished it. In the end, there are a host of witnesses saying she made these promises, and that is good enough for the consistory to force her into the match. Now, interestingly, if she had said what she said to a friend, as comes out in one part of the testimony, if she had said before the consistory that she had been forced to promise to marry Antoine Dumas, she might have had better grounds for getting out of it, because the consistory doesn't believe in forced marriage. It believes that you have to consent wholly. But she never says that before the consistory. She takes another line of defense, this one about being married to Jesus Christ, that makes her look impertinent. And so her fate, of course, is to be forced to do what the men of the town want her to do.
Why do you think she went for such a, it's a pretty bold defense?
I don't know. I mean, it's a theocratic society. You think perhaps she thought that, appealing to divine reasoning or to stressing the nature of her faith, that prevented her from this worldly match would have been powerful enough. Or maybe it's not calculated at all. Maybe she really did feel that in her heart of hearts that was the dominant relationship of her life, and that she didn't have the energies to give to this marriage.
Now, a lot of the cases that you've discovered in these archives that you've worked with, that you've investigated, you've written up in Voices of Nîmes, are to do with marriage and are to do with disputes about, hey, you said you were getting married to me. Yeah, well, I was drunk, whatever the case may be. And it's this area of male and female interaction that seems to come up in your work again and again, for obvious reasons. So there's another example I wanted to talk to you about, which is concerns Isabelle Viel, who's a Catholic girl who forces a recalcitrant Protestant man to marry her. And there's a sort of a rather good third character in this, which is a sort of hellcat mother-in-law as well, I seem to remember. So perhaps you could tell us about this one, because this kind of flips the previous example in the sense that where we had, with Gillette, who said, no, I'm married to Jesus, doesn't want to marry a man. Here we've got things working the other way around. There's a man who doesn't want to marry a woman, but it's a bit more complicated than that. So tell us about it.
Well, also what's interesting about it, as you said, is Isabel Isviel is a Catholic, and she is trying to use the Protestant consistory to get a Protestant man to marry her. So she is also a young woman. The man to whom she says she's engaged, Claude Dupont, is a weaver. He's probably around 20 years old. She says they've gone through the ceremony of promising to marry each other. In the 16th century in France, this is you drink in the name of marriage, in colloquial custom. You say you're going to marry each other, you have a drink in the name of marriage, and you promise to give your bodies to each other. And that's engagement. If you then go on to have sex, you're married without having to have an intervention of a priest. And she says that this has taken place, that they had gone for a walk together. They chatted about a vineyard that she owned, and they had gone to the house of her uncle, Jacques Dubois, and there they had drunk in the name of marriage and promised to marry each other. Claude Dupont completely denies it, and is also quite insulting about Isabel. He says that she's a papist, she's a drunk, and a whore, and a thief. And he repeats this character assassination more than once. And he also says that she's gone to the nearby town of Arles and been pregnant while she was there, or had been pregnant and gone to Arles to give birth. So, he thinks very badly of her, and he refuses to marry her. But the problem is, she keeps to her version of the story, where he keeps changing his. So after a while, he says, okay, well, look, we did go to her uncle's house, and we did drink, but it wasn't in the name of marriage. And I also said I could only do it if my mother consented.
And we only had sex once.
It doesn't really count.
Right.
That's when the mother, who lives some distance away, his mother obviously hears about all of this and turns up and is absolutely furious and says she will disown her son if he marries this woman, she doesn't consent. And the age of consent under French law is really important. By this period of time, a man has to get consent from his parents or a male guardian if he's under the age of 30. His age is a bit in doubt at this point. She says he is under the age of 30 and I don't consent and he's not going to marry her, and et cetera, et cetera. And it looks like it's all going to go horribly wrong for Isabel. But the problem is, for Claude, is that Isabel has good witnesses. She has four people who can say, look, yeah, it did happen. The engagement has been enacted in all the ways that the church say it should be. The consistory still clearly don't want to favour this Catholic girl instead of the Protestant man. But
he's banged to rights.
It goes up to a synod, a level above the consistory, and suddenly out of the woodwork appears an uncle of Claude Dupont, who says actually he is old enough to consent. He may look 20, but he's actually over the age of 30, and I give my authority for him to marry anyway, and Isabel gets her man. Whether she wants him or not by that point, after he's called her a thief and a drunk, I don't know. But perhaps she had been pregnant, in which case it would have been hard for her to find another spouse, and she makes the most of the opportunity.
Now, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on marriage. However,
you have been married quite a while.
10 years, thank you very much.
So that's,
I mean, I'm experienced, that's a different thing. However, this doesn't sound like the basis for a happy marriage. But if you've been up for the consistory, calling each other sort of, whore, slattern, drunk, all of this sort of thief, all of this sort of stuff. Do we know how things turned out between them?
We don't. And this is the sad thing, is that the cases then disappear. So sometimes I was able to follow cases up. Sometimes in the baptismal records, for example, I could find, then they went on to have five children and know how long they lived. But unless something else goes wrong between them, they don't come before the consistory. And that's one of the downsides of this set of records, is that most of the time I'm working with where there have been moments of social breakdown, where people have disagreed, where they have a difference of opinion. Happy marriages don't tend to make it into the sources. They write white, as the famous expression goes. So if they were happily married thereafter, or even if he left her and there's no sort of paper trail, we wouldn't know about it.
When you're working through these cases, I mean, do you start to feel sort of close to these characters? And is it frustrating when they then disappear from your record? Or can you not allow yourself that kind of emotional engagement?
I would like to say that I'd managed to maintain a certain objectivity throughout, but actually, of course, you get really engaged with the cases and want to know the outcome. And it's such moments of victory when I've discovered some other reference to them in some other set of sources. One particular case I was looking into where a woman doesn't get the man she says has promised to marry her, but I was cheered to learn that a year later she's married to somebody else. And I'm like, well, okay, so obviously things have worked out. It's okay for her. But most of the time they disappear.
So we've talked about two cases which pertain to marriage. one of the other big categories of cases that comes up before the consistory is sexual assault, sexual misconduct in sort of broader sense. Tell us a little bit about Andavalati. Who found her husband and a maidservant committing adultery, I believe on a sack. She's a classy guy. And she goes after them with a most unlikely cooking implement, and not in a good way. Tell us a little bit about this case, and because this is, I mean, it has elements of sort of what in an English context would be Chaucerian bawdiness about it. But it also has a victim as well, maybe even more than one victim to it. So talk us through this particular case.
Yeah, so quite a lot of the cases that appear are cases where we've got an older male employer having sex with a servant girl. At this time, this is an age of life cycle service. So people go into service at the age of about 13, women particularly. And then they're trying to raise money for their dowry, which can take 10 or 15 years. So until their mid-20s, they're in a house with an older man, and quite a lot of these women have sexual relations with older men or are sexually assaulted. Who knows what happens in this particular case? This man is called Pierre Cordonny, and his wife, Anne Valetti, they keep their own names, finds him having sex with this maidservant on two occasions in a room just below the main house, which is used for bolting grain and wheat. And so when she finds them on this sack, where presumably the grain had been carried in, she hits them around the head with a sieve. And
first thing that came to hand.
Exactly. So, and what's amazing about this story is she never appears before the consistory. We never have her testimony. We just have other people who've seen her. So there's a man called Pierre Balafrat who had seen her coming out of her house crying and saying to her neighbours she couldn't believe her husband had done such a thing and they should take care to make sure their husbands didn't do that sort of thing with their maids, and telling the story. And so we have testimony from other people around it. In the end, she goes absolutely silent. She's called before the consistory but won't come, which is interesting in itself because clearly if you want to have a happy marriage, the last thing you want to go and do is denounce your husband in front of the consistory and say he did this, unless you particularly want to get revenge by that point. It seems that she decides to bury the hatchet and remain silent. But we know about this incident because other people talk about it.
And what of the poor maidservant?
She gets sacked. Ha! Huh. No pun intended. And we don't even know her name, unusually. Most of the time, at least, they get named. But I can't chase her down because she's not even named in this case.
I think you alluded to the villain of this next case a little earlier, but tell us about another serving girl who's assaulted while she's in service. Jeanne de Gaucide.
Jeanne is also known as La Gascon because she's from Gascony, and she's a servant girl, and she gets pregnant by the womanizer I've already mentioned, Pierre Cordonny, who is the father-in-law of her employer. And he's a sailor, and this is one of a number of times where he impregnates younger women. And he owns up to it as well. I mean, he doesn't have any shame about it. And this is a particularly sad case because she gets pregnant, tries to disguise it for some period of time, and she appears first in the sources when a married couple bring a baby to Montauban to be baptized into the faith of its father, as a Protestant. And when the story was investigated, it becomes clear that she had become pregnant and gone to her employer for help. And her employer had said that she should take some medicine with which to bring on the menstruation, i.e. to cause abortion, and cause a surgeon called Pierre Gobi to come and see her. But it turns out, you know, she's already too far gone. But obviously she gets hold of something because the next snippet we have is from one of her female friends called Astrid Capelan, who says that Jeanne came around to her house to stay the night and said that she was taking this medicine to purge her liver, which was overburdened. And Astrid says, well, clearly that's not the case. You know, you've got a big belly and your big breasts. You must be pregnant. You can't tell me that you're not pregnant. And we have this direct speech reported, at which point Jeanne, you know, obviously relieved, perhaps, to be able to tell her friend, says, yes, actually, she is pregnant. She's 7 months pregnant. She's pregnant by this man, Pierre Cordonnier, and she is so wretched and despairing that she is carrying with her a knife to kill herself if this medicine doesn't work. And so that gives us an insight into how servant girls might feel if they're made pregnant outside of marriage. They become unemployed. They have a child to raise. Their chances of marriage in the future are very slim. And there's no consequence at all, really, for the man in question. But the story has a sort of happy ending in that because we see her sending the baby to be baptized into the faith of his father, we learn about the case. It comes to the consistory's attention. And so Pierre Cordonnier is called to justice. And it looks like Jeanne has manufactured this situation in order to create exactly that effect.
Explain that a little bit further. She's manufactured this situation in order to bring him into the public eye and have this time of reckoning.
Well, she's Catholic. And so she has to deputize a couple to take him, the child, not just to be baptized anywhere, but she says take the child into the city of Montauban, which is where the assault has occurred. So it's happening before his church. And then when your baby is baptized, you name the father. So this couple names the mother and father. And so it directs the light of the church onto this illegitimate pregnancy.
So in a way that it was possible, even if there are many elements within society and institutionally that are kind of loaded against women, it is possible, as we've seen from a couple of these cases, for women to use this system to their advantage in some way, either to bring men to a form of social reckoning or justice, or just to have their voices heard.
Exactly. And I think there is something in that. Even if they don't get what they want, the fact that somebody has heard their case, that they've had it written down, which, you know, has an almost sort of mystical quality at this point in time for most people who are illiterate, that someone has paid attention to them is considered really important. And there is a level of justice. They occasionally can get the man they want to marry them to marry them. They can get some sort of retribution or some sense of justice. It is a limited amount of power in a patriarchal society, but it is something. And what it does expose is the way that women tried to get this, that they would approach the consistory or other authorities in pursuit of their own ends. Even when they didn't get what they wanted, the fact is that they're demonstrating so much agency in order to try and get it in the first place. And so it makes us think again about notions of women being completely oppressed. Women did have power in a very quotidian way, and they could use it in their domestic circumstances.
There's one more case that maybe you could say a little bit more about, which is about three women in Ganges carrying out superstitious rituals to heal a child. Because this case is interesting, I think, because it doesn't quite touch on the same issues of sexual morality, adultery, sexual assault that we've been talking about so far. So maybe broaden out the scope of other things the consistory could deal with.
Yes, yeah, so this is a story of these three women who turn up with a sick child to Ganges, which is a little village in the Cévennes, and they get the help of a local cunning woman. So somebody who was involved in making herbs and healing, and she's called Don Figueres, but she's also known as La Sauvage, which means the wild woman. And they go to make basically a sort of offering before St. Peter. They light a number of candles, they put a loaf of bread out, and they do this in the cemetery. And all of this is considered by the consistory to be sort of deeply superstitious, this kind of ritualistic healing or attempt to heal a child, rather than just simply pray, is entirely forbidden. And this instance is an interesting example of ritual. They light nine candles. They do perform all this before this saint. But we have all sorts of examples of women doing this, going to see a local soothsayer to have a prayer, or perhaps it's an incantation said over a child. Perhaps there's some writing or a bell rung over the child, all these things. And the church finds all of this deeply problematic because they're trying to encourage a faith that is shorn of all this ritual and all this superstition and is just very simple one of belief. And yet at the same time, we see even in these really Orthodox Protestant cities, people clinging on to these vestiges of either Catholic ritual or more superstitious ritual, because when you're dealing with the healing of a child, it's something, you know, you really care about, and they are seeking solace in it. And in some ways, the church doesn't offer that to them.
How long does this system of the consistory last in French history?
So it's only a mere, well, less than 150 years, where it sets up in 1559 and is completely at an end by 1685, because Louis XIV revokes the Edict of Nantes. And the Edict of Nantes had been a declaration allowing Protestants freedom to worship in certain areas of France. And by revoking it, he says that it is not permissible to be anything other than Catholic in France. And so the Protestants are sent to the galleys, ships, or they are imprisoned, and many of them flee. And then we have this huge Huguenot diaspora across the world as a result of that. But in practice, I stopped using the records in around 1615, because after that, the church starts to decline in its level of confidence. And so as records for the sort of thing I was interested in, as sources of social history, they become less rich. So it's only a really, you know, short period of time. I look at them for about 60 years. And so we have this, you know, insight for these few decades. But I think what they're showing us is an insight into a form of behavior that is going on otherwise. It's just that we don't have records capturing it at other times.
So this is a really amazing kind of window into a sort of snapshot of just a few decades of French society that we have existing in those records.
And exactly. And we shouldn't think there's anything particularly exceptional about the women that I'm looking at. They just happen to be have their stories written down, and so we can read about them. But we can imagine that either side of those 60 years, women are still trying to pursue justice and to force men to marry them, or to get out of marriages to people they don't want to be married to, or whatever it is, because, you know, there's no reason to suggest that these are particularly unusual.
People have been hitting their husbands with sieves for sleeping with their maids for, you know, time immemorial. It's just that at this point we can see it happening. It's been written down. I just want to ask you one more question, which is, I suppose, to talk more generally about the practice of history and about how we're doing history today. This feels like a book that's really, really germane to the times, you know, to the early 21st century when you've been writing it, in the sense that it's about women's narratives, women's voices. It's about understanding a period in which the patriarchy, or, you know, a patriarchal society has worked in a particular way, loaded pretty much against women. Did you approach writing this book specifically as a kind of a women's history book, or is it just a book that happens to touch on the female experience?
If I had started this research in the last couple of years, as opposed to, you know, more than 15 years ago, then I would certainly have looked equally at the stories from men's perspective. But it was partly about the copiousness of the sources. I look at 1,200 cases in this book, and I read a lot more. Those are the ones that have been useful to writing this. And so at the time when I was deciding to do it, it was just a way of filtering the material somehow to focus on women's narratives, and also because it gave an insight into women's power in a way that I felt that other records hadn't done by that point, and it had things to say about women in society. Now, I would also want to think about how that had implications for men. And if I were to go back and read them all over again, that would be what I would be drawing out. But I do think there is something about this present age. If you think about recent books that have been published, a lot of them are giving the other side of the story, whether that's in fiction, thinking of, you know, Natalie Haynes recently writing a book about you know, the Siege of Troy, or all the books from the ancient writers, but telling the women's perspective, or Hallie Reubenhold telling the story of the victims of Jack the Ripper. There does seem to be a sense in which we are finally recognising that perhaps it's worth paying attention to that 50% of society whose stories haven't necessarily been told up until this point.
And it's so often been said, oh, you can't tell the stories of women, the records simply don't exist. And I think what your book proves amply and brilliantly and elegantly and surprisingly entertainingly for a book that, you know, sprang out of a PhD thesis. And that's, I mean, that's wholeheartedly as a compliment. what this brilliant book of yours shows is that it is absolutely possible to write about women's experiences in history and in doing so, produce a book that illuminates so much about society in the 16th century, in the early 17th century, but now as well. I think we're coming towards the end of our conversation, which is a source of great regret to me, although I can talk to you anytime. Our listeners are going to bid us farewell. So I would just take this opportunity, I think, to recommend with every fibre of the fabric of my being, Susanna Lipscomb's new book, The Voices of Nîmes, Women, Sex and Marriage in Reformation Languedoc. And I'll read one more. I'll embarrass you by reading one more of the encomia from the back of the book, which is by Kate Moss, the best-selling author of Labyrinth. She says, this is a scholarly, extensive and imaginative piece of history, essential reading for all of those interested in the hidden stories of the Reformation and in hearing the everyday voices so often left out of the history books. I don't think we can add anything to that.
That was Susanna Lipscomb in conversation with Dan Jones. The Voices of Nîmes, Women, Sex and Marriage in Reformation Languedoc is out now, published by OUP. Meanwhile, Dan's latest book, Crusaders, was released earlier this month, and you can hear him discussing it on the episode that we put out on the 9th of September. And you can catch both Dan and Susanna at our History Weekend events at Winchester and Chester this autumn. Find out more details and purchase tickets at historyextra.com/events. And that's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Thursday when Max Hastings will be talking about the Dambusters.